wonder, Mr. Min, if it would be helpful at this point to describe your experiences at Hudson Motor Car Company in the late 30s, and a little bit about Frank Spring and the people that you worked with there.
As I mentioned a little bit before, I retreated from General Motors after they had a financial slowdown in 1938 in the spring, March, and so I came back to Pasadena and spent some time here. But I'd interviewed with Frank Spring at Hudson before I left, and so in the fall I got a telegram from him simply offering me $175 a month, which was more than I'd been making at GM if I'd like to come back. So I did, and joined them in that fall. Spring had been hired by Hudson as a styling engineer, and his experience at Hudson, his experience at Murphy had been more, he had been fascinated with foreign cars for one thing, subscribed to many European publications that dealt with body design, and from those derived new ideas. This is plagiaristic, but it's a fertile field from which to draw innovation and even constructions. So that was his familiarity. He even persuaded Murphy to buy a few cars. They had a Hispano Suiza for a while of their own, and also a Bugatti.
You didn't have to meet him on those Saturdays, did you?
I had, yes, I met him once. Yeah. And he was a medium height person of a very pink complexion. He was, his second wife was very much a health addict, and as a matter of fact, conducted until recently, as I understand it, a health studio in Hollywood. He was famous for sleeping on the floor and doing exercises and eating the right foods. He was way ahead of his time and all of that kind of thing.
Did he take an army fat?
Yes, very much. And also an aviation enthusiast, flew his own plane. Later on, when he was working in Detroit, he had a Steiger Wing Beach, if that means anything to you, which is the enthusiast airplane and certainly ahead of its time. He had the smaller engine of the version that's 185 horsepower Jacobs, not the 450 horsepower Wright Whirlwind. Anyway, So he was technically oriented, and he loved innovative new ideas, which were a little bit perhaps on the novelty side. This is not to say that his sense of taste was knocked away by novelty, but it got perilously close sometimes. So he was employed, the reason that he got hired by Hudson was the fact that Murphy traded his dealership, a distributorship, I should say, for Lincoln, with the fellow who had the Hudson distributorship, made a swap. And there was some other kind of deal probably involved in that. The reason being that originally Hudson had been a very strong factor in the automotive market, but they gradually diminished, as I mentioned, because their cash flow wasn't quite that of the major corporations, and so they began to coast down. Murphy had done prototypes, as they did for other manufacturers as well, for Hudson. And the bodies that Hudson had built by Siemens were semi-replicas of the bodies that Spring had supervised in construction here in Pasadena. So he had that orientation.
Siemens?
I said Siemens, and I hope I may have to swim past that one in a hurry. Now, Siemens did work for Nash. Now, who was it? I'll have to leave that alone for the time being, because there is a name, and I can't recall it, that did the body production and the subcontractor for Hudson. So they had the familiarity and in the contact, naturally. Spring made himself attractive to Hudson, and in 1930 was offered a position, or sought it, I don't know which, and was hired as a design engineer, I said styling engineer, which put him in a pretty good place because he could work with engineers himself, and he had to, and with A.E. Barrett in particular, who had been with the company since 1910, and was a pretty dictatorial sort of a member of the hierarchy. He could handle that situation reasonably well. He had the ability to present design on his own foundation because he had already submitted designs they had built, and so they could rely on it, they felt. He was a mild man, as I said. His language was precise. He, if anything, in personality to me as a very young person, seemed rather cool, but he evidenced, as he always did, little elements of enthusiasm every now and then about exciting ideas. One of his good friends was Abner Doble. He'd gotten to know Doble, of course, when they built the entire Series E Doble bodies, in Pasadena at Murphy's. All of those were done by Murphy. And so there'd been a great connection there. When Dobell finally moved to Holland, Michigan, they kept in contact, and so I remember one project that we did was a little three-cylinder compound rear engine, three-wheeler aerodynamic thing where you sat in front of this engine assembly. And it was a pretty exciting idea. It was extremely low, probably was down around 48, 50 inches high, which is damn low for 1938, and everything else is up around 60, where it seemed to be.
Did they get to the prototype stage?
No, this is just a little design exercise that he and Abner shared in enthusiasm, and Abner says, why don't you get your guys to do some suggestions on this thing? So we got to work on this, and when we had a lull.
Any sketches were made?
I don't know if they did or not. I didn't have any. I just, you know, later people got wise and would take things mm-hmm. with them when they left, but I didn't. Not that they didn't want them much, but it was a great experience. Well, when Spring was given this job, he had a small office next to it, a room in which he would have maybe two or three designers. And in 1938, he began to expand this thing, and by the time I got there, there were, I guess, six or seven of us. Let's see, we have Art Kibiger was his right-hand man. He's the assistant in charge. Yeah. And there's George Fullerton was a designer draftsman that worked in the same small room next to Spring's. And the rest of us, Jackie Aldrich, Jack was also up there in the front office for a while. He came back and joined us informally occasionally. The rest of us were in a small room down at the end of the building on the other side of the accounting department. And we were separated by a wood panel wall with opaque glass in it, which is a common procedure in big office rooms those days. So we had this small section down there. It was Holden Cotto, Bob Cotto, better known as, who was probably one of the great designers of that whole era, unheralded until he finally wrote his own biography, in Special Interest Autos. And John Foster, my good friend, who had grown up in Wisconsin but came out here, and his father, well, that's a side trip. In my going around to different car dealers and trying to find somebody to talk about cars with, I ran to the Buick showroom one day and talked to this one salesman who turned out to be John Foster's father. He said, I have a son that would be interested in talking with you, and so he got us together. Either a bicycle trip up to his house or down here, one of the two. So when I went to GM, Frank Hershey had asked me if I knew anybody else, and I recommended John, and so he came back and worked with us starting in 37. Well, in the lull in 38, we both were let out of General Motors, so John went down and got a job with Spring, and so we wound up there together again. So he and I and Earl Hovey, who was a good designer but more of an anecdotalist, a real entertainer, and who knew good things about music, such as Duke Ellington, which I hadn't heard of until that time. And let's see, and I said Bob Cotto, and so there were the four of us in this little room down at the end. Well, I mentioned the eraser fight earlier. That's one technique of letting loose a little bit of pressure. Because Hovey was a kind of a dramatist, we developed a little thing we called Indianapolis. Well, this has to do with all of the archaic old plots for movies where you involve racing cars. Naturally, there's a brand new prototype with a special secret carburetor, and it goes out on test on the track, and it's an erratic car, and so we have the startup. Each of us had a role in this thing. One guy would do the grinding of the starter, the next guy would pick up the sputtering of the exhaust as the engine warms up, does its initial revs, and then takes off down the track. This is all taken, of course, from radio recording type things that we've all heard. So we get the car, and then Earl was the announcer. He's the fellow that is describing the advent of the car. There it goes, ladies and gentlemen. It's off down the track, going through the south turn, coming around, looking very smooth, coming up the backstretch. Incredible speed, going into the dangerous north turn. And so we do this dramatics. My role in this thing, besides doing the tire squeals as the car goes out of control in the dangerous north turn, was to hold up an old hubcap, a large hubcap full of nuts and bolts and a pair of pliers. I stand up on a little ladder. At the right moment, this is this terrible thing. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, this is terrible. This car is out of control. It's screaming. And then I drop this thing, and this terrible crash, clatter, bang, 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 and tinkle, tinkle. Well, next door in the accounting department, there's all this tick, 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 because of these girls running these calculators or whatever they were, and typewriters and so forth. And we'd finish this little episode, and we did this, maybe once a month or something like that. There would be dead silence. And the supervisor from the room next door would simply open the door. It usually became a routine and say, was anybody hurt? And then close the door and go away. So this is one of the dramatic little incidents that you get into an automobile design, which has nothing to do with the development of the state art, but is indicative of the character.
Too bad you didn't have recording devices like we have today.
It's just as well. I think in recalling it as it happened this way is more fun.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it it would be pretty straightforward, but you'd like to vary it a little bit from time to time, which we did. We did.
You're obviously devotees of the techniques of broadcasting that kind of an event, or these are a simulation of that kind of event.
What it says is the broad enthusiasm that automotive design enjoys. It isn't just the myopia of aesthetics, but it's the performance aspect and the character elements and the projections that good automobile design will do. You put on a Buick Riviera and you become an elite person of sorts with a little bit of performance involved, you know, or if you get into a Pontiac or even may take a competitor car or something else. But so you're really playing a role when you're driving a car, and that's what Earl knew, and that's what Spring had something in mind of, but not as adept. So the little interlude of 6 months at Hudson was pretty exciting, and then, as I say, when the lull was over and the economics began to pick up, why we got the call that you might go see Howard O'Leary and see if you can get your old job. And of course, the fun part then was going into his office. And I remember this nervous moment because I really wanted to get back at GM. That would be the place to be because that's where all the good people were. And Howard says, okay, well, how much do you want? And I don't know what to say because I'm a real neophyte. All I like to do is draw cars. Do I have to put a figure on this thing? Gosh, I've got to get some money. I knew John had been making, so I said, $200, and okay. And then you realize, of course, you could have said $250, and he would have said okay. But, oh yeah, there was a preliminary. I missed it, I blew the whole thing. I'm stammering along, trying to think of what to say, and he said, well, come on, blurt it out. Which, of course, freezes you right there.
Yeah, right.
He knew that.
Well, O'Leary's been mentioned many times, but there's not really much been said too much about his wonderful technique with young, with the apprentice designers coming in for the first time. He never really tried to send them off. He wanted to give them something to go away with.
Being a lawyer, he knew how to manage people very well. That's why he was so good in his job. Mm-hmm. And as I also mentioned, he was a raconteur and a storyteller par excellence. He was really something special. He could come in and he and Mitchell, but they were different flavors, could do this. Mitchell would leave you rolling, aching on the floor, laughing, and you wish he'd stop it, and you wish he wouldn't. You know, he could just tear you up completely, and he still can. Mm-hmm. And O'Leary was good, being a good Irish storyteller, that was his forte, among other things. So he could put you at your ease, or he could demand an important performance, and he was an excellent man for Earl to have, and Earl knew it, and he rewarded him reasonably, but as I explained, Earl would take devious routes toward his objective in order to be able to cover all the bases and be sure that he was getting the most out of his staff and the adventure. So it was frustrating to everybody below him. Well, you wanted to know more at Spring. I think I should mention the fact, going back to Frank Spring, that he lived at the Whittier Hotel down along the riverfront, maintained his own Steyr Wing Beach airplane, which I did mention, was a health advocate, slept on the floor, married, I'm not sure how many times, I think either two or three, and had a pretty exciting life, although when you met him, you weren't quite aware of this, but the man was quite an adventurer. He was actually killed in an automobile, and I think it was going 300 SL by an oncoming driver that got on the wrong side of the road, and he went instantly. His wife survived, but he did not. But that the fact that he was driving a Gullwing Mercedes tells you something about the nature of his entertainments.
What did he do for Hudson? Was he able to bring them out of the doldrums a bit?
Well, in a way, yes, because he would let the designers go whenever there was a lull in order to explore new territory. And I think he recognized the tremendous talent in Bob Cotto. Bob was a designer that worked in three dimensions more often than he did in two, but was adept in each. His drawings were precise and absolutely beautiful, and he had a great aesthetic sense. But he could manage three dimensions, which is really the ingredient in doing any kind of a design. You just don't do side views or top views or whatever.
Right.
And he worked primarily in clay, and he was an easygoing guy. Really a very pleasant person to work with a good sense of humor, but not an extrovert. He was just a neat guy to have in the environment and his tremendous talent. During one of these lulls, Spring offered them the opportunity of developing an advanced concept of a car, which he did, and this would be in 1938. Well, as I mentioned, their cash flow was so low, but during World War II, they were able to recoup a lot. They did a great deal of government work and built up their finances again so that they knew that they had one more stab at this whole thing. They could do an adventuresome presentation, which you know I'm getting to is what we call a step-down Hudson. Well, that basic body design was created by Bob Cotto in 38 during one of those lulls. He did a, I would guess it would be a quarter-size model, And I remember watching him do it, and it had all those characteristics of the high belt line. And it was Spring's idea, being an engineer, to do the peripheral bumper, the bumper that goes down the body sills outside, and does it go around the rear wheels? I can't remember, but it created a little bit different kind of architecture so that you would, to get into the car, you would step over the high body sill and then down to the lower floor. So that's where the step-down thing comes from. Well, he created the essential body design, which then, of course, because they couldn't do it before the war, they just simply put it on the shelf. But Spring remembered this, of course. And after the war, when the big adventure came to pass, why, he pulled it off the shelf, and the designers that he had on staff at that time maneuvered this thing, refined it, and developed it. But that it was Cota's design, really.
He did not come back to Hudson after the war, did he?
Spring? I don't know.
Cota.
Oh, no. He went to work for Briggs and retired from Briggs and then Ford.
Right.
And at Briggs, he did some marvelous stuff. But no, he'd been at Briggs before he was at Hudson, because he worked on the what became the Lincoln Zephyr program, but it was really the 1933 World's Fair car, so I'm not sure if it was itinerary, but wherever he's been, well, he went to Studebaker after the war, that's what it was.
Yes. And it was involved in the famous 1949 Ford episode.
That's after the Studebaker thing, and if you look at the milestones along his career, and I don't know where you'd begin, but I guess that 33 World's Fair car that becomes the Lincoln Zephyr, then he goes to Hudson and does that thing that's a step down Hudson, then he does the 49 Ford, and before that he does the works with Exner and that gang on the development of the Studebaker. So he's all of the great designs of that period, he was a prime factor. And he didn't want to tell his story until much later, because he's on a Ford retirement. And he felt that it might endanger that livelihood and maybe sour his relationship with Ford, which is beneficial. Can't blame him for that, but it finally all came out. That's, I think, as much as I could say about Spring. He was an easy enough man to work for.
How would you characterize his influence on the administrative end of design?
Well, it's hard to say, because, as I said, there are so many pitfalls or restrictions with Hudson. They didn't have the opportunity of making a big adventure except that one car. And it was a difficult hierarchy to work with, because they were engineering and administrative oriented. The people that were at the top had been there for a long time. There was no new fresh blood with whom you could deal that was reserved and independent, I guess is the way you would put it. They would make the decisions. And you're familiar in your talks, I'm sure, with many executives who, as they rise in time through the ranks, develop an authority that is overwhelming. Who's the great engineer, Keller at Chrysler, would stroll through the design department, I was told, and pick up a piece of material and says, yes, that's good, use that, with no abrasion test, no fire retardant test, none of the other things that would determine whether it was really an adequate material. His intuitive authority based on long experience. That's a good product. Use that. Well, those kind of decisions, that's the peril of the business. And we've seen that happen over and over again. So in Spring's case, he had a problem, I think, dealing with a hierarchy that was not necessarily receptive to brand new thinking, and it was desperate to stay alive. So what Lilly could contribute. Now, they were building, I don't know if anybody's mentioned this, all of their prototype development, their full-scale stuff, was done not in clay, but in plaster. And if you went into that room where they were doing this stuff, and you've ever seen a plaster room in action, it's incredibly messy. It's just, it's the worst thing in the world. There are fragments all over the floor. There's plaster dust everywhere. Of course, if you're working on this thing, you've got to wear a mask, and even though you still might get some of that dust in it, you never lose it. Dutch Darren complained about the fact that his prototype work done in plaster had created to his ill health that caused his demise, but that's something else. So this. If you can imagine how ugly a model will look, where it's a big soft shape, you've got the same cowl you've had for a long time. The carryover parts were a real problem. And I mentioned the roof business, when they're trying to deal with the V windshield after you've had a flat windshield, which means the corners are too low in the front. They got into this applique business, which everybody did when decoration became the way to go. You could only stretch steel so far when you're stamping fenders and doors. And so the softly rounded form was the mean for everybody. And you could vary this a little bit. Maybe there's a little tighter curve at the top of the door before you go into the window area. or maybe the turn under at the bottom is a little more gentle. It did all sorts of variations, but still, no, none of the sculptured styling that Earl promoted later on in the 50s. Well, if you've got a series of models and you've got a commonality in body forms, or certainly in door interchangeability, how do you disguise this stuff? So the thing about somebody, Earl, really, discovered the art of applique, you know, taking the chrome strip or multiples of the same and putting these onto the basic body form in order to give you a different proportional read. So at Hudson, they're into this with wild abandon, you might almost say. Their front ends were composed of a series of bars. They finally got rid of the idea of the radiator grille early on, maintained the idea of a strong nose to indicate to the driver and to the oncoming observer some sense of power. Their forms were relatively cliche, and so they're really doing their own type of decoration, which got pretty damn well out of hand by the late 50s. Well, as I say, they're doing this on full size on plaster. You take off a strip, add on another piece of plaster, extrude that on, sand it into shape, and plaster on plaster on plaster gets different colors, yellow, bluish, and then there are pits, and so this marbleized effect, and with all this applique stuff, and it was pretty hard to see what a design would really look like. So you can't blame Spring for not being successful necessarily in achieving a tasteful orientation of applique. If you're looking at the damn thing and Barrett comes in and says, yeah, I like that, do it, without a discussion, without an opportunity to represent an idea.
Applique, simplicity described would be?
Adding on pieces.
Yeah.
And this is in strips, for example, or panels of bright work, which are simply represented by, in this case, by raised elements, as a strip is added onto a basic surface without necessarily being foiled for brightness.
What would be your adhesion?
Yeah, plaster on plaster, just sticking plaster to plaster. Not taking a separately molded piece and attaching it.
No.
And they were pretty clumsy. It was a hard way to go. Just at the tail end of 38, they hired a young fellow, young Polish local guy, Pete Wozena, W-O-S-C-Z-E-N-A, I think. And Pete and I got to be very good friends, and I sold a car to him and so on. My first car. He had some clay experience, and I'm not just sure where, but then when he came into Hudson, they put him over in a corner and let him model details like tail lights or license plate mounts with the rear deck handle involved and so on, and gradually he oriented them to the use of clay, which is that Chavant clay, wax base. C-H-A-V-A-N-T. Chavant Manufacturing Company in New Jersey, Red Bank, I think.
It took him 5 minutes this year. I understand that Harley Earl was instrumental in introducing clay into automotive design. Is that true?
That certainly is, absolutely. And his brother tells a story of how he and Harley, when they were kids, were on vacation with their parents in a rural environment, and I'm sorry I can't be more specific. This again has been written, but just to recap very quickly, playing around in the stream and pulling mud out of the stream and making models of cars on the stream bank, which I guess they were probably in their 9 or 10 years old when they did this, and Earl exhibiting at this point the idea of smoothing a form tactily using this raw clay that you get out of the stream, which is his first orientation. He was the first man to do a full-size clay, that is to direct a full-size clay at Cadillac, and Joseph Thompson, T-H-O-M-P-S-O-N, who was a clay modeler, well, started out life as a young man polishing brass at Cadillac and learning clay. How he did this, I'm not sure, because there's obviously an overlap, and his biography has never been published, which is a shame, but he has written one, autobiography. Does this clay model for Earl, and would have to be 1929. Earl starts a note, might be 28, because if Earl begins with Cadillac doing the LaSalle for 1927, you know, he comes back in 1926, and so this would be his orientation, and Joseph Thompson was the guy who modeled the clay for him, among others. He wasn't alone. So he brought that sense of tactility. There's a gap in there. When Earl is working for his father and then developing designs for Don Lee, he models or has modeled areas of the body, such as the cowl section between the hood and the windshield, in a flowing pattern in order to properly visualize this design, which you could show in a sketch or you could do as a surface development, but it's better to see what the actual shape looks like. So yes, he definitely pioneered that three-dimensional design development idea.
Until then, what had been the technique for making models?
Well, that's a good one. There are two things that pertain. In the original days of the automobile industry, there are body suppliers who supply complete bodies to the manufacturers who are really just chassis manufacturers, and even in those cases they will subcontract engine production, for example, and axles and wheels and so on, so it becomes an assembly process. And Ford, in particular, was, as you know, at Highland Park did that. These body manufacturers have their own drafting sections. The draftsmen were the designers. There was a man who ran a school in New York who had been founded by the carriage industry, and then this later translates to the automobile business as those carriage manufacturers became body suppliers, body manufacturers, in either the custom or the production line. His school was bent for apprentices who wanted to enter that particular field, and he taught a drafting process that involved geometrical processes for development of form, which exists today. They're now called keys, but in these cases, these geometrics were the method of accurately transcending from one section, cross-section of a form, to another different one. And this would take place throughout an entire body, or very emphatically in the cowl area of the body, which is the distance between the hood and the windshield. These designers, such as they were refiners, really, and didn't innovate that much except for what little information would filter down to them from the media of the day, which wasn't very much. And this is the point where styling really had an instant overture. These so-called designers would innovate primarily according to the demands and wishes of their clients and for what little design innovation they could create themselves. So there wasn't much progress in it. It's more a case of refinement. In relation to what happened in clay later, or what Earl was trying to do, they were able to develop form accurately and then relate it to the manufacturing processes, whatever they may be. There's a form of a press that would shape a cowl, for example, and they would understand how to design the form to be adaptable to that process. Most of the bodies were wooden framed and then paneled with metal. This process continued with General Motors through 1934, and they gradually began to evolve all metal body construction. The first man to do all metal, of course, was Edward C. Budd, who did his first production body for Hupmobile back in the, I think, 1910 or 11, somewhere very early like that. And most importantly for the Dodge brothers, when they left Ford and decided to manufacture their own automobile beginning in 1914. So the evolution of the steel body had an effect on what the designers did, these so-called body designers who were really draftsmen. What Earl has done is bring in a three-dimensional visualizing process that was flexible, as in the case of the composite body construction and done by a drafting designer, you would simply build the thing and see how it looked. And if it was okay, then you'd accept it if you wanted modification, but that was a lengthy process and might have been a little bit more expensive. And what Earl wanted was far greater flexibility, of course, in being able to orient many changes and drew radical innovations in proportion, which he was able to do in clay. Now, the finished models, however, that were presented at General Motors, even when I got there, were called wood and metal models. And these guys who built composite bodies and were really great wood craftsmen had systems. One of them was carried over from carriage construction, where you'd have a basic series of frames, and the space in between would be occupied by what looked like a little brick wall. It's a whole little series of wooden blocks glued together, and then surfaced on the outside, and then scrimmed, which is cheesecloth dipped in vegetable glue, and then laid on and smoothed on by hand, and then allowed to dry, primed, sanded, and varnished. Well, that whole process was related to Earl's prototype models, these wooden metal things that they built. They would cast or form in brass or bronze the metal parts that were to be bright, and then have them plated, chromium plated, and chronium, as Mr. Earl would say, And the main body forms would be built up out of wood and then scrimmed and sanded and finished, which is a very long and expensive process. In those days, I believe a figure that I remember hearing for the 34 LaSalle prototype presentation model, wood and metal model, was $100,000, which was a lot of money. So it was a pretty full commitment. Usually there might be a few little changes at that point between that model and the final production version. And these can be found. I have photographs of the wooden metal model of the 34 LaSalle, for example, and they have a slight difference in the windshield, which its construction, and some other minor details. So that the relationship with carriage building practice has an overlap as it goes into the prototype development for styling models.
Was plaster still used at GM as well?
Not very much, only in some small detail areas and at the probably to suit the convenience and skill of the craftsmen who are making these presentation models, such as they may be. I remember guys of the industrial design department. Chris Klein was one of the craftsmen that did detail work on all sorts of things. He modeled all of the Cadillac emblems, which are a woman striking out horizontally, if you remember, and with chromium-plated buttocks, very handsome. And so all sorts of things. When they're doing small detail work, they'll use a very high accuracy medium, such as they did then, a plaster. Now there are better materials, of course, but that was the alternate material at that time.
Klein was, how do you spell Klein?
Klein, K-L-E-I-N, Klein.
Can I ask you one more question before we leave, sure. Leave fabrication? Do you remember the Stobart brothers? Did you ever?
Sure, absolutely. Worked with both of them.
Can you tell us a little bit about their impact on the fabrication?
Probably more so since they went to Ford, but when they were General Motors, they were clay modelers.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, one of their sons came through Art Center later, second
Did
point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Leonard and
Charlie.
Well, Charlie was one of the modelers in the Oldsmobile studio when I came in there in 1938, which is when I came back to GM after Hudson. That's the studio that I was fortunate to be assigned to.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really sort of starting over. George Snyder had the studio up to that point, then they gave it to Ed Anderson, and the Stobart, Charlie Stobart, and another man whose name I can't remember at the moment, were the two clay modelers in residence of that studio. And in the absence of a designer, after Snyder had left and when Anderson came in, they also did the visual presentations, and I remember they're doing some airbrush drawings of front-end designs in which one would hold the airbrush and the other would operate it. So it was kind of like the old idea of how do you sculpt a full-size clay in certain areas of the world which you shall not prejudice? Well, you get one guy to hold the knife and then 18 guys are moving the model. It was that kind of thing.
Well, the modelers and the fabricators are really the unsung heroes.
Oh, you opened a wonderful door. Absolutely, because these men are the ones that make it happen. Their sense of surface and their skill is monumental and subject to sometimes the whims and the exploration of the designer. Now, just to diverge a shade, in training automobile designers these days, everybody does this. It's essential that the designer have some three-dimensional experience in this automotive clay made by Chavant. And through that, of course, then they have a better idea of how to orient themselves to a really skilled clay modeler. There are many cases, if it's the union permits, where the designer can go in and actually himself or herself sculpt the area in question and interpret it, but the sculptor, the professional sculptor, usually knows better on how this whole thing can be done and do it much faster. So yes, unsung is the real word. What's interesting in a way, byproduct of their performance, which is usually impeccable and very swift, and they're the most sure people in the world of what they know and what they can do, which puts them in a high priority of their own world. When they look at the designer, they sort of will accept perhaps this neophyte and go along with it if it's directed. But in the process, they develop a defensive mechanism which manifests itself in a very, how do you say this, unique sense of humor. It tends to be sardonic and highly critical occasionally, and it's difficult sometimes for the designer because they like to talk to each other a lot. They prefer Western music, for example, in their environment, which is not pleasant for the designer, necessarily. There's no Basie in there. Then they have these little practical jokes that they like to play on people on top of all of that. So winning the confidence of a clay modeler is the best thing that any good designer can do. Well, what they do in the environment is a distraction. It's incredible. You can't believe it. They certainly have developed a language that is primarily vulgar. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the designer catches on to this, and that's kind of a kicky adventure for a while, but after a while it gets abrasive, too. Mm-hmm. They're unique people. Some of them are true fine artists. As you know, at Ford, many of their great sculptors have come out of Cranbrook and places where they have studied fine sculpture, and they are artisans. That shows up on those days when you have exhibits of your hobby work, and both Ford and GM do this, which is tremendous. The sculptor is the man who makes the design truly happen. It's his work that is responsible for the whole thing. The designers can take a lot of credit, but it's the sculptor who really does it. And they've, I'd say in recent times, have been honored with salary levels and accreditation that's justified.
So very recently they were really second-class citizens, in a sense.
Yeah.
At least administrative, not certainly study.
No, that's right. Well, they couldn't dictate a design, but they can tell you what it's not going to work. Okay. Well, we're winding this thing up as far as pre-war experience goes, and so this is the truck and coach business up to 1938, then coming back and working in the Oldsmobile studio, which is pretty exciting.
Did you say
Ed Anderson, and that's spelled like Anderson Soup or anything else that you care for, with an E on the end, S-E-N.
You say he was an engineer by training?
No, Ed, I don't know where the heck he came from as far as training went. And he was one of those people that fell into the business. He liked cars somewhat, but I don't think he was really bitten by the design bug that much. And as such, many administrators, when they realize their creative powers are a little bit shaky, they'll work their way right into the hierarchy as quickly as possible. And if they can become managers, then they are relieved of the responsibility of direct contact. They can tell people what to do, and he was okay at that. And it was became a pretty good friend. He later went to American Motors and then left there, and he's living now in retirement in Mexico. So, all right. He had a rage temper that would manifest itself justifiably, I would say, in some cases, and turn absolutely beet red, and then it would disappear. But there would be this moment of just absolutely pure madness. Anyhow, he was running the old studio, and do we need to go over that Stobart business?
No.
All right. There was a very small cadre in the studio when I came in there at that time, and. It was a very pleasant experience. Jack Foster and I worked there together.
Did you?
Yeah, for a while, until he got moved elsewhere. Well, okay. Then comes this World War II thing.
Anything exciting happening at that time? Was there a feeling that the war was coming on and things were you were going to mark time, or was there?
Just going? Like right now, everybody was looking and wondering how soon this thing was going to happen, because England's already in it.
Right.
And you just think it's maybe a matter of time, but you sure hope that we can stay out of it. And then, of course, it becomes obvious that we can't, and we're going to get committed, and then they're beginning to get this law going about drafting, and you'll just be drafted for a year. You don't have to worry about that. That doesn't seem too bad. Okay, well, I hope I don't get picked right away. Of course you do. What happened as far as the studio is concerned, Oldsmobile, which is kind of interesting, the 1940 Oldsmobile, what are you saying, which you're designing in 38, was a success of sorts. Oh, there's a feature in design which has been covered in print, but we'll mention it briefly. They had a great theme in this particular design in which the belt line coming along the base windows come forward along the hood, turns down and goes across the front fenders and back into the wheelhouses. This creates a loop line. Dropping below that loop line were two vertical panels of fairly strong, vertically ribbed chromium-plated texture, and then the area in between was a very fine bar texture. Now, this had been created under the previous studio head, George Snyder, who had a great sense for design and is really a profound man in design. He also was a big fellow, a great sense of humor, a little bit on the sarcastic side, not a little bit, and he was sure of himself. Before he'd come to General Motors, he'd worked for Brewster and Company in New York and created some of their most innovative designs. Mm-hmm. Well, he left the studio and Ed Anderson comes in, and at this point, Earl has developed a technique for evaluation on the front of the automobile, which is the most important thing at that time for identification. Right. It used to be the radiator shape, now it's the area that has taken that place, and the distribution of headlights and other details, bumper shapes and so on, that make up the sense of character. And he became convinced that The buyer approaching the showroom had already pretty much made up their mind because they'd identified the car at a distance on the road. If you could see a Buick coming a quarter of a mile away and identify that car, that gave you insurance about your pride in the ownership.
Sure.
Representation.
Really bad.
Well, I mentioned a little while ago the idea of light value on chrome, and this is where it really came into play. So on this particular Oldsmobile, they took it up to the rooftop, which was the first daylight area that they had, and when the weather was tolerable. And if you backed away from the car, the fine bars in the center grille disappeared because the space was greater than the size of the bar. And so the ratio, of course, would overwhelm it. And if the grille went black, then it meant it had no visual impact. And how to save this thing, and Earl's direction was to put some heavy bars on it every now and then. That is, say, about 5 inches apart, there would be another heavy bar going across, and to shape that bar very specifically so it would catch overhead light and reflect it into the consumer's eye. So all the chrome had to be inclined a little bit. There was an idea of putting little notches along the bottom edge. I remember doing, in a couple of days, endless series of sections of applied chrome bars that would be designed to catch light and to become important under all conditions, because as you know, in a four-season climate, it gets pretty muddy and murky, and a car can be covered with grime, but if the bright stuff will still show through all of that stuff, it retains its impact, and that he felt was an important marketing advantage. So light value on chrome, really big point. So we took this lovely Oldsmobile design and mastered it by putting these occasional heavy bars, which had a groove along the bottom of the bar and red paint in the groove. I mean, this is about the most insurance you can get. And that went up to Lansing, and that's what they made.
What year is that again?
That would be the 1940 model, which is the year they brought out the Torpedo body, which is probably one of the prettiest bodies that GM design ever did, certainly through that period. And 41, we immediately attacked that design and developed it, and it went through some terrible stages, and the 42 that we did was even worse. Taking that same theme and trying to adapt it, or in 42's case, to do something really radical, in which the bumper is a has an extra extension above it and becomes part of the air opening surround, and words don't really suffice, pictures do the job better. Anyhow, it got mixed up so badly through modification and indiscriminate adaptation for more air. Those days they're using vertical radiator cores and we're trying to get horizontal radiator openings. Mm. And the engineers just simply told us that you could baffle all you like, but if you didn't have direct flow to the core, it wasn't going to do any good. Of course, since that time they've learned better, but that was their absolutely standoff opinion. They would not renege on that at all. That was it. So you had to get air opening where the core was, which means that you start sequentially opening up areas above this horizontal slot, and you get a pileup of detail. It's pretty awful. Well, the 41 got worse, but the only thing I was going to mention about this, on the 41 design, the headlights were relatively close together, and then the surface outside the headlights wrapped around the corner very gently into a nice flow. But John Oswald, whom you mentioned a moment ago, was the chief body engineer for Oldsmobile at this point, and he felt that he was something of an aesthete as well. He didn't mind standing up to Harley Earl if he had to. He was a big fellow, big gruff voice, an impressive person, and also had a pretty good sense of humor. When he saw the design as proposed, and we had parking lights outboard of that that were buried in this chrome strip that went out from the headlights in a nice flush way, No, he's got to get some point of focal visual interest out there, so we put little round lights on top of the chrome strip and added stalactites to the bottom of them in order to emphasize that point. We didn't know that until we went up for the preview of the new model at Lansing, and when we saw this thing, it was too late because Oswald had done his number. And so it was but he was right in the fact that otherwise it would look like a cross-eyed kid. You know, this two eyes really close together. Well, when I mentioned Oswald had a good sense of humor, in my wonderful new affluence of being a designer here at General Motors with a little higher salary, around $220, I think, at that time per month, I'd made friends with a man that had worked with Gordon Buick on the Cord, Vince Gardner. Vince and I got to be good friends. He was a little older, and John Foster and I admired him enormously because he was tall, handsome, and could really wear clothes and had a gorgeous girlfriend, and had worked on Cord, so he had a Cord, an 812, as a matter of fact, unblown. What they call a FET, a convertible four-passenger, and I used to look at that car and think, someday if I were big. Well, it so happened that the fever got too hot, and I kept reading the newspaper and found one advertised by a flight lieutenant up at Selfridge Field. The guy only wanted $550 for it, and I didn't have the cash, and I had this Ford that I have to sell,
But I went up to see it anyway and came back and told Vince about it, and it was a supercharged model. And Vince said, you know, I've always wanted a blown car, and he was really sympathizing with me. He knew much how much I wanted that car that he had. So he agreed to buy the car from Selfridge Field, get himself a little more powerful version of it, and sell me his old car for $450, and this is a 1939. Wow. How little can you go for a car that's only a couple of years old, and a fabulous car at that. Well, I drove the car to work, and as you know, in Detroit, it's sunny like this in the morning and beautiful, and by noon it's clouding up, and by 2 o'clock it's raining, and by 4 o'clock it's sunny again. So I'd leave the car with the top down on the parking lot outside down below, just outside the window. We're looking down about 9 stories. And Oswald came in, and I told him, he had mentioned that he had been the chief body engineer for the L29 Cord body, and I said, well, that's fine, because I just bought a Cord. You did. Well, where is it? And I took him over to the window and said, there it is down there. Gardner had painted the louvers that went around the front of the car. The car was black. He painted the louvers a bright vermilion. And Oswald said, leaning down the table, where'd you get that whorehouse red? You know, for a kid, that sets you back a little bit.
Right.
So I guess.
So the military claimed you just about this time.
Trudging right along, yes. I had registered from Pasadena here, and then was because I had the idea of, I hoped if I had to go in for basic training, it would be in a reasonably pleasant climate, which it turned out to be. I got basic training at Monterey, which is great, the old Presidio, and then got shifted out of a four-door infantry outfit and assigned to their headquarters as a draftsman working in the S3, which is operations section. Minor detail. Anyhow, that was pretty good fun, but I had a cousin who was a West Point graduate, and he convinced me I should go to OCS, which I then did apply for and got, which was in Ordnance in Aberdeen, Maryland. And that many weeks later, came out as second lieutenant, saluting the first sergeant, of course, like they always do, and got assigned to the 8th Air Force headquarters in San Francisco, which is a very hard assignment to take because it means that you had to stay up late every night having a good time and get to work in the morning just the same and write those letters and do whatever it is you had to do. Well, what they were doing is they'd take these neophytes, these green kids out of OCS who really didn't know which way was going up, and orient them gradually into the system so they didn't make a mess out of it too badly. I remember the old colonel that ran the system who told me how to use third person in writing a letter in order to get an authoritative statement without saying I think and sort of thing. It was a pretty good experience. While I was there, they had an operations room, and somehow or other it came out that I'd been a car stylist. So they asked me if I would make a design proposal for the operations room. Well, I did. I designed a very elaborate and very formed wooden table that would have to be made out of a lot of glued up blocks and shaped by some careful craftsman. And so I made a lot of sketches for this thing, and that's fine, and left well enough alone, and got shifted eventually to an outfit at Muroc Air Base out here in the desert, and then eventually to
what was the name of the air base?
Muroc Air Force Base. It's one of the, well, it's the Dry Lakes.
M-U-R-O-C.
Right. And later I had a chance to go back up to the Air Force headquarters, and my God, they built the table.
Really?
Yeah, they did the whole thing. Right. And then at that point you wished that you had done a better job. So that little design adventure there. Mm-hmm. Well,
it's good that they utilize your talents in several
ways. It was a pleasant experience in that respect, yeah. Yeah. Got assigned eventually to a combat outfit to go overseas, which happened to be a fighter squadron with P-38s. And if anybody ever loved airplanes, P-38 must have been the most desired of all. Mm-hmm. It was so dramatic to see it do a barrel roll because the twin fuselages rolling around the center axis were highly dramatic in their motion. And it's a big ship, and the twin Allisons and the turbochargers giving it a very smooth sound as opposed to the bark that you get in open exhaust in P-51s and so on. A unique ship. Well, our CO, I'm not going to go too far with this, but our CO was a great guy. He survives. Can't remember his name at the moment. But anyway, it was his policy, because we had a piggyback when we were stationed out in Ontario, getting ready to go over, is to give everybody in the whole squadron a ride, one at a time, and in relation to their position. Well, my job as armament officer, or ordnance, I should say, dealing with the bomb supply and that kind of stuff and the ammunition supply, I got to ride on a practice dive bombing mission, and I'll tell you, that's really something when you flip over at whatever altitude and head straight for the earth, and you don't know if the man's going to pull out. Of course he is, but it seems like it never is going to happen. And then when he does, you forget about the numerous G's that are pushing you down, and my chin, these things are very crowded, and your chin is on over his shoulder. but it's in his shoulder at this point, and I can't get it out. It's pretty thrilling. And he take it back up again, and just before it would stall, roll over in his back, Immelmann out, and yodel, because he loved flying. Just fascinated by it.
What plane were you flying there?
It was a P-38.
Okay. Oh, still a P-38.
Oh, yeah.
That was used as a fighter bomber as well.
Yeah, we went over with 38s, and they were used for escort missions, as you know.
Yeah.
And then...
Where was that, by the way?
Well, we're located near Bury St. Edmunds, if whatever that means. It's in the southwest part of England, which... The fighters had less range than the bombers, so we were located a little further toward the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that was a good experience. I'm not going to get into all of that because it's personal. I did steal a car in Belgium. We eventually moved over to Belgium, went over there with a P-51 outfit. And at that time, we were installing K-14 gyro gun sights, which were almost dead sure insurance of a strike. It's a hand grip that is developed by the British but refined by the Americans. And it's on the throttle is a hand grip that rotates, and you can contract or expand a sequence of six diamonds around the visual target that are reflected in this, that sits just behind the windshield, the reflector device. And if you get the diamonds right on the target, it takes care of all of the lead that you need and everything else, senses the motions on the airplane, all the dynamic forces, and you press the gun switch at that point and you've got it. So naturally, the pilots were just, they all wanted it right away, and we were only putting them in maybe two or three at the very most a day, sometimes mm-hmm. not even that.
Right.
One of our ships crashed over the line, just made it back over the Rhine. We went up to retrieve the gun sight. At that point, General Simpson had ordered all the GIs who had been walking and picking up cars as they went to turn them in, because they'd stopped at the Rhine. We found an old Jaguar that nobody wanted in this collection pool and drove it back to the base, fixed it up a little bit, tuned it, and so forth, and the engineering officer and I were in cahoots on this. We went up to see our CO, and he was up in the tower, and he said, "Sir, you're tired of driving that Jeep with the plywood sides. Wouldn't you like to have something nicer like that?" And he agreed that would be pleasant. I said, "Well, it's yours, sir, if you will let us have it occasionally for a trip." So we did. I had a couple of trips, one to Lille, one to Brussels. All you had to do was have an enlisted man for a driver. I had a friend who was an enlisted man. As soon as we got outside the gate, we'd swap places and I get to drive the car. So that was the automotive experience overseas. Anyway, came back. GM was just great during the whole thing. They kept in touch with us, and then before we were through, after VE Day, they sent over, I remember, some promotional material about the new cars that were coming, and everybody was really hungry for cars at this point. And to say that your old job is waiting for you, come back and see us. They'd sort of put us on a kind of a leave of absence thing. It was really pretty nice.
Yeah,
that's
great.
Right. So I did. Went back for 6 months and back to work for my friend Frank Hershey.
Ah.
But at this point this is very important as far as Earl's strategy is concerned, because not enough to have a separate studio for the exterior and interior of each car. They had separate interior studios at that point. But you've really got to do some adventuring on your own in order to present a point of view, because if everything has to be approved before you do it, you know you're going to get too many hierarchical no's. And he knew this. He'd have to take a flyer. So there's always what we call a room in the basement, which nobody knows anything about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hershey's room in the basement was actually the big auditorium up on the 11th floor. And this, they'd sent Les Johnson, who is a member of the industrial design department, who also happened to be a photography expert, with his Leica, 35 millimeter yet, out to a mountain in Colorado in Estes Park, and he stood on top of this peak and shot a 360-degree panorama, which they then reproduced with photo murals in this auditorium, so that as you stood on the polished floor, there's sepia, but it's like looking through a brownish window at this magnificent landscape. Well, now, if you're from California and you're working in a room with no windows, it gets to you. And so I had this wish.
Was that the way it was on Milwaukee Avenue?
No, yes. This is still before the tech center.
Yeah.
So that was one of the factors that contributed, and then the fact that in doing these special projects for Frank, where they're making alternate body proposals, which is what we're up to, things that were beyond the normal scope at that time. So, doing a little more adventure, maybe a little smoother sweep, a longer window, more slope to the windshield, whatever. And I asked him at that time, feeling that I had some contribution to make, and in my own self-estimation that I could do that, said, could I have a modeler in about 2 weeks to do a project, because I think I know what this thing could use. And I'd asked a friend of mine what to do, because I was up against it, and he suggested that I ask my boss if I could do this, and if he did agree to quit. And so that's what happened. I made the proposal, it was refused, and it was really kind of funny, because Hershey thought that it was really kind of silly, and I just said, okay, I quit. Well, I'd met some pretty good guys in the Air Force when I was over there, and one of our pilots was, after he's released, went back to his home in Ohio and to get married, and he sent me an invitation to his wedding, so I did. I went down on the weekend, and if anybody has never had any experience in the great Middle West, it's something that's terribly lost, because those people are the greatest in the world. They are totally honest, they have all kinds of vitality, they're vigorous, they're just great people, and I had never known this in this little country town of Chillicothe.
I am.
You know what?
I've been through it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Donald Bulgamore, who was the pilot's name, introduced me to the local labor guy who set me up. I decided after I quit that I'd go back down there, and I thought maybe working on a farm for the summer would be a good idea, and it was. Mm-hmm. So he got me the local farm relations. The first job was an all-day deal on what they call a harvest day.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's incredible. This postprandial languor has nothing to do with the company. Sorry, conversation.
That's all right, you got good teeth.
Sort of cleared away the cobweb.
Yeah,
the
sure.
On the farm.
Yeah.
How to do that?
Well, I spent the summer working for him. Then after that, he set me up with a job working for a great old Dutch farmer. Recently married, and I had two little kids, and it was just a great experience. Lived in an old, what had been a slave headquarters way back, and a very substantial building, and had a little room up on the top, and it was an especially good experience when it came to spreading manure. Well, that's one of the things that you did. You cleaned out the farmyard, loaded it into the wagon, and took it out in the field and spread it.
Lifeblood of the enterprise.
Yes, sir, and you took a really good bath after that. Well, and then left and came out to California. I had read in some magazines something about industrial design, really didn't know what it was all about, but I'd seen a picture of who was supposed to be a great industrial designer. She sure as hell was, Henry Dreyfuss. And in the picture, he was leaning over a desk with his shirt sleeves rolled up, and he was conferring with a designer about an idea, and I said, that's the guy I'd like to work with or for, because you'd learn something. You're not working in a hierarchical system, you're doing a job together. Well, that wasn't necessarily true. It is true that Henry was certainly involved with every project that ever went through his office in all the phases, and he was the super salesman and a magnificent man. It couldn't have been a better experience, but I didn't know that. Anyhow, when I came out, he had recently moved his family out from New York City because he felt that sending his children to school in a taxi cab was somehow wrong socially. It just was, there was something missing. And he and Doris, his wife, had wintered out here or spent vacations out here in Pasadena, liked the city. So they bought an old house on San Pasquale Avenue, not far from here, and set it up. The sunroom was the office. There was a little studio out in the back, which was Henry's office. And then beyond that was upstairs over the garage was a chauffeur's headquarters, which became a drafting room. And then there was also a little chicken shack out in the very back, which was cleaned out, and we used that for a modeling headquarters. He'd acquired a contract with Consolidated Vultee, and these big organizations after World War II were trying to find some way to utilize all that space and personnel.
Right, yeah.
So Consolidated was going ahead with some follow-up operations for light aircraft observation types, and somebody, a fellow named Ted Hall, had come out with an idea that he'd already practiced once at Southern Aircraft, and the prototype had led him to better things, and so he had newer ideas of a flying automobile. Well, that was their big deal there, and Vultee, which is down here in Lakewood, was possibly going to do prefabricated housing, which aluminum siding, of course, with foam sandwich in between. They hired Edward L. Barnes, who was a promising and now a very famous architect, to do that part and to manage the office. But neither he nor Henry really knew very much about automobiles, and when I showed up on the scene and indicated that I had worked in styling, just the fellow we need, so I got the job, which is a fluke of fate again. Well, it turned out very well, and so we did the flying car, and it did fly, and I won't elaborate on that. It was quite an adventure. So I worked for Henry for 5 years. That got me into product design. And again, I think an essential experience for the automobile designer to be able to spread out like that, because those elements of responsibility and design, however simple they might be, as in the case of farm implements and John Deere, where you're working with castings and sheet metal stampings, brake forms, And very simple stuff to compose good design out of that is really an experience. It's not just the demand, but it's the artfulness with which you can manipulate these things. Henry Dreyfuss was a master at understanding all of that, and a totally sincere designer, so it was a great experience. Well, during that time, I went over to see some friends. Now, I didn't mention this, but when I went to Art Center one summer in 1935, a summer course. Are we running out of time?
No.
It's the only art training of formal sort that I ever had outside of high school. Well, while I was there, these two guys were just finishing up, 35, George Jergensen, J-E-R-G-E-N-S-O-N, and John Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. Two great people. John was doing a car model, and so, he became a mentor and everything else. He was a fabulous guy, probably weighed 125 pounds wringing wet, but it was all steel muscle, and a very intense but dedicated man, and became later at Art Center, I think, our finest teacher in all truth in product design. Anyway, these two guys had, we had worked together in that Opel design section in 1937 and kept track of each other, and Jergy stayed on back there in Detroit, and then he finally came west, and John remained in Detroit and worked for Laudriere Advertising Agency doing automotive illustration, which he was very adept, and so on. Well, Tink Adams, who founded Art Center, Edward L. Adams to be exact, knew after World War II he needed to reform his industrial design department. He had it, had Kim Weber, who was a brilliant architectural designer, running the thing pre-war, but he knew he needed to expand it. He felt that there was a greater promise, so he always kept track of his graduates and where they were, and he brought both of those guys out and had them reform the department post-war. During the war, they'd done technical illustration instruction, which is essential when you've got neophytes coming in to make aircraft parts and they can't read a blueprint, but you show them an expanded view and they can understand it. So I went over to see my old friend.